Good morning, this is Hugh LaFollette, your host for Ideas and Issues. On our program this week, I'm talking with John Doris, professor of philosophy at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and we're discussing his book, Lack of Character, Personality, and Moral Behavior. John, glad to have you on the show.
Hello, Hugh.
Wonder if you could begin by giving the listener just a brief synopsis of what you try to do in your book, Lack of Character.
Well, I guess the best place to begin is just to say that in American culture and probably Western culture in general, character is an ethically central notion. To be a little bit less fancy, we could say that how we think about people's character looks to have a lot to do with how we think about them and how we treat them, even in matters of substantial importance. So that's why we have things like a McCain advisor telling the New Yorker that no one's going to elect us because we have the best health care plan or tax cut. This race is about character. And similarly now when we're talking about educating our children, there's lots of talk about character education. Now all this talk, if I'm right, presupposes a certain picture of character where character, to put it loosely, helps ensure behavioral reliability. So that if someone has a character trait, they can be competently expected to act in accordance with that trait. So if someone is brave, they'll stand their ground even when it's hard to do so. And if someone is honest, they'll tell the truth even when there are substantial incentives, as there often are, to do otherwise. So if that's the rough picture, it looks as though that picture is fairly substantially at odds with the picture we get from thinking about a long tradition in social psychology where we find that behavior is extraordinarily sensitive to little variations in situation or circumstance. So if I find a dime, or I guess nowadays 35 cents in the phone booth, I might lend you a helping hand if you drop some papers, and if I didn't, I might not. Looks like something like a dime is a bit of change is making the difference and not the state of my character. So the thought is, if people had reliable characters, we wouldn't see that sort of situational variation. But since we do see that kind of extraordinary, again, situational sensitivity, it begins to look plausible that the explanation of that phenomenon is that people are not, in fact, reliable in the way we seem to suppose when we're voting for people on the strength of their character. And if I'm right about this, given that character is an ethically central notion, or a particular notion of character is an ethically central notion, if we began to take the social science seriously and the history seriously, we might begin to revise some pretty deeply entrenched ways of thinking about ourselves and others.
Let's look at the various elements of what you just said. I mean, the very first thing seems, I think, pretty obvious to most of the listeners, that rightly or wrongly, we do often look at other people and look at ourselves and make judgments about ourselves and other people in terms of character traits. We describe someone as being honest or loyal or trustworthy or benevolent or mean-spirited. And when we do this, we assume that we're saying something interesting and important and profound about them. You say that conflicts, though, with what social psychology tells us. Can you explain why it is that it conflicts with it, or the ways in which it conflicts with what social psychology tells us?
I think the way in is to think about oftentimes character evaluations like steadfast or reliable, that kind of talk of persons seems to presuppose that a person can be counted on to act a certain way. And what the psychology suggests is it's hard to, let me put that another way. We probably shouldn't have much confidence that people can be, in fact, counted on to behave in certain ways when we observe them outside of the typical range of situations that we do observe them in. So it's, of course, quite true that Under ordinary circumstances, we're teachers, we show up to lecture, we more or less attend faculty meetings and so on and so forth. But the thought is that when the social reinforcements for a pattern of behavior dissipate, we can no longer have the confidence that people can be counted on. And this is what looks like happens when we get horrible ruptures in the social fabric, Rwanda, Nazi Germany, or so on and so forth. Culture starts out, it's normative, more or less normative, that is expected that people will not systematically brutalize and murder one another, have an extreme political movement. The ordinary social restraints are removed through various incitations to violence and so on and so forth, and the nice guy next door is chopping up his neighbors with machetes, quite literally in the Rwanda case, and equally bad, although different methodologies, in the Nazi case, or any number of cases, since we'd like to think those cases like that are isolated, but looks like it happens over and over. And so one way to look at it is to say, well, why do those kinds of things happen with relative frequency if people have sturdy characters? Now, of course, it could be that what we have sturdy characters, they're just rotten. But it looks like in other situations and other social arrangements, people are at least morally mediocre, if not morally admirable. So why does it happen if we're built or can be trained to adhere to our moral principles even when there are strong disincentives to do so? Because remember, many of these people who do these terrible things, there's evidence to suggest that antecedently to being immersed in the problematic environment, they endorsed ordinary sorts of moral principles, and in fact sometimes behaved rather heroically. Wirth, who was the chief medical doctor at Auschwitz, medical officer at Auschwitz, treated Jews in his practice after it had become illegal to do so, presumably at some personal risk. Then he comes off to Auschwitz and starts supervising the systematic slaughter of Jews. This is not an isolated case, but this kind of inconsistency in people's life narratives is something that's been identified over and over. Inconsistency between principle and behavior. So people appear to maintain ordinarily humane principles or moral beliefs, judgments, convictions, but these are fearfully easy to short circuit, it looks like, with environmental change.
So your view doesn't deny that there are ways in which we can, in fact, make reasonable predictions about how other people act, but we do so within a fairly tightly prescribed set of circumstances. So, for example, I can assume that my neighbor isn't going to come over under ordinary circumstances and chop me up with a machete. I assume that my colleague is going to be predictable in certain sorts of ways. That, I take it, is at least not unreasonable to assume that people may be predictable in those ways. It's when people move outside of their ordinary patterns of interaction that you're much more likely to see these seemingly aberrant behaviors.
Right. I think that is, you wouldn't make much money, or your students wouldn't make much money betting on you to show up at lecture naked, right? They can count on, and you're probably not going to sort of bring a fire hose to lecture and hose down the dumb questioners, right? There are lots of expectations that we can and do confidently maintain, and the question is what justifies that confidence. And the thought is that it's not reference to character. And that if you do base your predictions on personality assessments, and as of course many personality psychologists have tried to do, you'll be disappointed in particular cases surprisingly often.
And what the sorts of cases that may lead to these seemingly aberrant behaviors needn't be as dramatic as war or genocide. They could simply be something as small as Joe, who ordinarily seems calm, even-headed, benevolent, you see Joe in a squabble with a colleague, and suddenly he becomes vicious, nasty, spreading rumors about the colleague. I mean, is that the sort of thing you have in mind? That even small changes within fairly ordinary environments may lead people to act very differently?
That's the kind of theory that I'm advocating. Notice it kind of seeps into our culture a little bit when we think about the idea of having a fish tank in the dentist's waiting office or playing soothing music, that we can affect people's moods and affect their behavior and with fairly sort of modest interventions. It doesn't take something very fancy in many cases. But where the shock, and notice we can, presumably circumstances contribute to good behavior as well as contributing to bad behavior. What's shocking is how sometimes seemingly easy it is to induce morally unfortunate behaviors with rather slight variations in circumstance.
Perhaps it'd be helpful here to mention a couple of the social psychological experiments you think that are especially good at illustrating this point.
Yes, I suppose that probably the Milgram experiment, which is one of the most famous, it's a series of psychology experiments, actually, but basically an experiment where subjects were told they were participating in a study on the effects of punishment on learning, and at least in the standard variation of the experiment, two-thirds of the subjects were willing to administer to the so-called learner in the experiment, who is actually an experimental helper. They were willing to administer the learner electric shocks even when the learner, or rather a tape recorder of the learner, who's sort of off stage, as it were, is screaming about a heart condition and let me out of here, let me out of here, let me out of here. It's really quite gruesome. Now, somebody might, if you asked most people, would I torture a screaming human being because a geek in a lab coat told me to do it, the answer is probably no, unless, of course, they've become familiar with the experiment, which is now as well known as most high art social sciences, right? And I guess you probably wouldn't predict that your spouse would do that either, but actually there's a pretty good chance that he or she would.
Or would have prior to hearing about the experiment.
Yeah, one hopes, right? One hopes that as we learn about the kinds of situations that are risky ones, we can inoculate ourselves. That is, knowledge is power. And so at least in exactly that situation, you would hope if you volunteered to participate in an experiment on punishment and learning and it started to look chillingly familiar, it would be easier to withdraw yourself from the situation. Part of the thing with the Milgram experiment is it's a sort of an unusual situation. It was difficult for the subjects to make out what was going on in some ways because there's a way in which it doesn't make sense. And we know this, that people have much more trouble behaving in admirable ways when the situation is ambiguous, so someone is more likely to help in an emergency when they can see and hear as opposed to just hear. So again, this is another instance of knowledge being power, as it were, moral power. So the Milgram is the most striking one. A close second is the Stanford Prison Experiment conducted by Phil Zimbardo and one of my colleagues, Craig Haney, in the early 70s, and some others, where they took ordinary young men, made a fake prison, assigned some to the role of prisoners and some to the role of guards, prohibited physical punishment, but allowed the guards to coerce and control the prisoners in other ways. And famously, they had to stop the experiment after 6 days of a 2-week run because things had gotten completely out of hand with all sorts of the guards engaging in all sorts of adolescent sadisms, prisoners breaking down crying, breaking out in psychosomatic rashes. Now, of course, this is the kind of work that can no longer be done given contemporary ethical standards for experimentation. But where that kind of work, Milgram-like work, Zimbardo work, has been done, it looks like it doesn't take much to get people to behave in pretty horrible ways. Remember, Milgram subjects believed they were doing something not nice, at least, and they were extremely upset, tearing at their hair, pulling at their lips, so on and so forth, but they did it. Again, it's not that they had a principle, torture people if a lab tech tells me to do so. Rather, they had presumably principles that prohibited such behavior, but with altering the social environment, it looked like the principles or convictions, commitments they had were all too easily swamped in many cases.
All right, I want to continue talking about these themes in the second half of the show. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest today is John Doris, philosophy department at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and we're discussing his book, Lack of Character. You talk about the ways in which a person's commitments, seemingly moral commitments, can get swamped by circumstance. I wonder if we could fruitfully go back and talk about the Holocaust again as perhaps one particular example, very vivid example, of the way in which that could happen. That seemingly decent, ordinary, upright, moral people ended up participating in great moral evil. And I take it what you want to say that the social psychological literature shows is that it's the nature of the circumstances in which those people found themselves that led them to act in the ways they did.
Well, I don't think that we should, and I don't want to or need to deny that there are some people that are baddies, that is, they're psychopaths exist, and these are people who seem to be largely devoid of sort of ordinary moral sentiments, as we say, and much more prone than other people to engage in violence when it suits their aims. But they probably do not represent a large percentage of the population. So more troubling is the fact we know that it wasn't a couple percent of Germans who it wasn't a tiny minority of Germans that participated directly in, indirectly in, or countenanced horrible atrocities, but a lot. You may know about the rescuer literature. Very, very few people at their own risk tried to help people who were being persecuted. I mean, the exceptions are shining and wonderful, but there just aren't that many of them. So the question is, how can so many people be induced to do these terrible things? And it doesn't look like the answer is that they're pathological in any easy-to-describe sense. Indeed, you might say, if we're social organisms, one of the things that's scary about it is what you have are social organisms doing what social organisms do, which is being extremely susceptible to group influences. So the thought that it's a few evil men doesn't seem to capture what actually happens when we have organized state violence on that kind of scale. By the way, of course, this is true in American history. You don't want to just pick on the Germans or the Rwandans, you know, and take the My Lai massacre, right? These were mostly, as far as we can tell, ordinary young men, but were in a situation where military policies were such that it was well known that they weren't going to be too picky. Superiors weren't going to be too picky about who was getting killed. So if you're in a climate where people are saying, if it's Vietnamese and it's dead, it's a VC, ordinary young men will do terrible things.
In the last sort of 8-9 minutes of the show, I wonder if we can talk about some of the, I mean, I think some of them are already clear, but talk more explicitly about some of the ethical implications of your view. And it strikes me, just in the heels of what you said, one fairly clear implication would be that if we're honest and reflective, we'll discover that most people, ourselves included, may be capable of doing really horrible things under the right circumstances. And that perhaps most people under the right circumstances are capable of doing quite noble things. Am I right? Is that an implication of your view?
The argument is not, I mean, we tend to focus on the dark side, I think, not just as philosophers, but as a culture. But, you know, there are these striking examples of people behaving horribly, but it's also true that people do behave nobly. And I think there's no reason to deny that if slight situational incentives make people behave badly in some, or help make people behave badly in some circumstances, the opposite can be true. Indeed, that's what the experiment I mentioned at the outset about finding a dime, what you got there is nice behavior. With a little boost to people's mood, they were more likely to help. So I think that it's absolutely true that one of the lessons is that if we devote energies to developing humane institutions, there's no reason to think that won't bear fruit. Of course, it's enormously tricky to say in the particular and concrete cases what a humane institution is. That is, what's a humane making institution, what will cause people to behave humanely. But I think that's exactly right, that in a way, although the historical story that motivates my skepticism about character is a bleak one, in a way it's kind of an optimistic story, because it suggests, or the sort of forward-looking part of the story is optimistic, because it asks us, what can we do to help ourselves do better? And there's absolutely no reason to think that there's not lots we can do to help ourselves do better.
So to that extent, some of the implications will be how we ought to think about what we can do to make ourselves more likely to act morally, to act responsibly. And in your view, I take it that means that there's some things that we perhaps shouldn't do or shouldn't do as much as we currently do, and there's some things that we ought to be concerned about, think about, that we don't tend to think about at all. Is that true? And if so, could you spell out what some of those things are, perhaps that we shouldn't do that we are now doing, and what are some of the things that we should do that we aren't doing?
Well, now we get to the hard part. I don't want to be a false advertiser. I'm not a social engineer or a social reformer, so it's going to be hard for me to speak in anything more than the most general terms. I think it's the idea is there's a style of thought here. So if you think about the individual level, what kinds of things can you do to make yourself behave in ways that you can embrace and admire, as opposed to ways that you feel badly about and maybe ashamed or guilty about. So you think one kind of study is, well, people, when they're in a hurry, it looks like, are less likely to help others. So one thing you might do is see what kind of things could you do in your life to make it less rushed. If you found, geez, when I'm in a hurry, when I'm running behind getting the kids to school, I snap at them or something like that. Nobody wants to do that. Now, my view is it's going to be a lot easier in the cool hour before you go to sleep to set the alarm for 15 minutes earlier than it is to not snap at the child in the heat of the battle while they're whiny and you're rushed. So that's kind of a simple example of the kinds of ways in which you might engineer your life, or think about ways you could engineer your life to have your behavior more in conformity with your values. And of course, you know, it's a further question what your values are. If you like snapping at your children, please be rushed. But seriously, again, the sword cuts both ways. But there, it looks like there are things we could do. Now, what does this have to do at the level of policy? Now, my experience, say, with the criminogenesis literature, that is, you know, what sort of factors, and I know you've thought about this too, because you've thought about gun control. It's really not easy to say what factors influence the sort of crime rates, as it were. But if I'm right, there are some broad theoretical reasons for thinking something like a broken window theory of crime has something going for it. Remember, that's the thought that if you clean up the graffiti and at least board up the windows, you're going to have less of other kinds of crimes too. And you can see how it's going to be easier to be the fifth person to throw a rock through the window than the first person. Right? So if you see chaos and destruction around you, it's probably easier to engage in chaos and destruction yourself. To put it one way, once it's been done, you've got a model for whatever reason. Maybe nobody broke the window. Maybe a tree branch fell into it. But there it is. You've got a model. Okay, that's permitted here. So that's a kind of example of something that seems to me very likely to be a plausible way of thinking about criminogenesis. Again, it's a complicated literature, and there's multitude factors, so on and so forth. But
so in general, you would say the emphasis, instead of being the emphasis on what's going on inside me, to be more concerned about what's going on outside that helps shape me. Or I'm wondering if this is perhaps a fair way of putting it, instead of talking about character education, maybe talk about situation education? Changing the situation so that we change the way that we behave.
Yes, and notice it's one thing that's crucial to think is, you know, so I'm a moral philosopher and thinking about it in terms of ethics. Notice that this idea of changing the situation doesn't mean that people are passive. These are the kind of things that we can do ourselves all the time, as in my late for work example, but there's other kinds of examples too. That we can do things to, as it were, cultivate our life and self-manage. My picture of human beings is not that they're sort of a sack of potatoes that is going to lie wherever it's thrown, but we are sensitive. We are sensitive to circumstances, of course, rather more sensitive than our sacks of potatoes. And there are things we can do when we're not under pressure that will help us to secure conformity between our values and our behavior when we are under pressure. That's the idea.
So for example, on your view, you could talk about self-control, but again, the way that you would conceive and understand self-control would be very different.
Yeah, that's right, because like everyone else, I think it's good for us to be self-controlled, and it's a question. So it's not that I disagree with William Bennett or the character educators that it's, you know, children vandalizing is bad, children beating one another up is bad. We may very well agree on the values. It's a question of how to realize those values in our lives. And there I'm worried, if you think we sort of only have so much attention, where do we want to focus our ethical attention? And if I'm right about this striking fact about human behavior, what I claim is a striking fact about human behavior, it might be better to place more attention than talk of character education or character in politics encourages us to do, place more of that attention on our environment, on our moral world instead of our moral selves. And by having a more moral world, we can have more moral selves.
Okay. I hate to say it, John, but we are out of time. I appreciate very much your appearing on the show today.
Thank you.
I've been speaking today with John Doris, professor of philosophy at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and we've been discussing his book, Lack of Character. This is Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good day.